Green is proudly sponsored by Pick and Pay, committed to a sustainable future.
Hi, hello again from me, JR. Yeah, today we're thinking about water. I wonder why. We've been thinking about water without pause for the last few weeks, for obvious reasons, and now we're really getting to the nub because I'm delighted to welcome Chris Hartnady. He's a hydrogeologist and really knows about the waters under the earth. Thanks for joining us this morning, Chris.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, there's been talk about the Table Mountain Group aquifer, which has come to light again, but this is something that goes back quite a while. TMG, the Table Mountain aquifer we all know is, carries water, and it went away around about the 2000s. We heard quite a lot about it, and now suddenly, in the times of need, we are talking about it again.
Yeah, well, it does go back to 2002, which was when the city first put out tenders on the project. It really began in about 2004, and there were 2 years of what was called the preliminary phase, which was really about reconnaissance over the whole area, selecting certain key areas close to existing infrastructure, because that was one of our briefs. We weren't going to go anywhere. We wanted to have something which was close to existing dams that we could easily feed into pipelines, tunnels, that kind of thing.
First things first, let's get back to definitions. The Table Mountain Group aquifer.
Aquifer takes its name from Table Mountain. That's the type area. But the area that we're considering is not anywhere near Table Mountain. It's on the other side of the Cape Flats. It's in the Cape Fold Belt, its western part. And where the rocks are folded, they go down to depths of between 2 and 5 kilometers in big basin-like structures. We call them synclines. And it's about nearly 2 kilometers thick in certain places near Villiersdorp. It's got different parts, and there's a lower part which is the more productive, let's say, because it's the lower part that underlies all of the high mountains. So any high mountain is generally the peninsular formation.
And we're talking about a huge quantity of water.
And we're talking about big quantities of water. If we've worked out the storage in just the fractured spaces. So the rock is a fractured rock aquifer. Water, it's about between 5 and 10% porous, which is not very much, but that's enough to allow water to filter through. And the key thing about the Table Mountain Group is that the rocks are very thick and very strong, and the strength governs the depth to which the fractures can remain open. And in this case, the fractures remain open to nearly 10 kilometers. And we know that because the rocks, the strong rocks, form the high mountains, which is where all the rain falls. And that rain percolates in the high mountains, travels downwards very, very slowly.
It takes a long, long time.
It takes thousands of years, hundreds of years maybe, but then comes up in the hot springs. And the Cape Fold Belt is one of these very rare places where we have non-volcanic hot springs.
And Chris, you paint such wonderful pictures. You could go on talking all morning about this, but people want to know how much, when, etc.
Yeah, so we have billions, which is many times more than the storage of the dams, of cubic meters in storage, but not all of that is accessible, of course. You've got to be able to draw in places that are accessible, and as I said before, it's got to be close to a place where it can be delivered easily to the people who use it. Therefore, only a few percent at most of that water is accessible, and it's released mainly in what we call the artesian or confined zones by compression of the aquifer.
And all these studies you've done, and there are test boreholes, and you've got the figures.
We've got figures, but what we don't have is a pilot project. So the original project was a feasibility study, which had a preliminary phase and an exploration phase, and various other elements, the kind of engineering planning, all of these things. So feasibility has been demonstrated, but with this kind of thing, you need to actually have a demonstration, and in particular, a demonstration that you can scale up. So that's the other part of the name of the project was feasibility and pilot project. And so around about 2011, 2012, we ended the feasibility study. We are all set to go. And the pilot project involved taking the most easiest area to try something out, get some holes in there, and start producing a small amount, not anything near what the city needs, but something like what a small town could possibly.
Well, that would be a great relief.
And so maybe up to 5 million cubic meters per year, and start exploiting that, and then learn as you go, and then start scaling up. And that's the big advantage.
Chris Hartnady, hydrogeologist. Wow. We've just scratched the surface here, literally. We haven't even got into the borehole. I'm going to ask you to come back and carry on the story and the future being green pretty soon. So thanks very much for joining us. And we look forward to the next exciting installment from Chris Hartnady, who is a hydrogeologist of note. And he's representing Umvoto Africa. Thanks, Chris.
Oh, thank you very much, John. I've enjoyed this.
This edition of Being Green was proudly sponsored by Pick and Pay, committed to a sustainable future. Reducing environmental impact while increasing efficiencies is a key focus of Pick and Pay's supply chain. The massive Longmeadow and Philippi distribution centers are of the greenest in the world. Pick and Pay is committed to minimizing its environmental impact by decreasing carbon emissions and improving energy and water efficiency. More distribution centers are planned, and they will help reduce supply chain costs so that we can pass lower prices on to you. Pick and Pay is committed to a sustainable future.